Haven't done this in a while. It's time to talk some New York Knicks with Chris Herring from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Brian Gibberman. This is the Podium Game Podcast. Chris, how you doing?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm doing great. All right, there's a lot of places we can start. Let's talk about Melo a little bit first.
Sure.
I think right now his play, look, there's still the lapses on defense occasionally, or there's still lapses on defense, I think, partially because he's playing out of position and being asked to things he can't do on offense. There's still the occasional bad shot, but I don't think it's anything overly horrific. Right now, he's pretty much catching crap because he's not making shots. Everything else he's doing is pretty okay.
Yeah, no, he's rebounded well. I mean, I don't know if he's still leading the team in rebounding, but, you know, I think a lot of people have to get used to the fact that Robin Lopez is not a 10-rebound-per-game guy. He boxes people out for other folks. And so Porzingis will get rebounds because of that. Melo will get rebounds because of that. But he's doing what we expect him to do. The efficiency is not going to be there right after a major surgery, I don't think. And, you know, good example, people got so excited with those first two or three preseason games where he was making everything, but they were all jump shots. And a good example of something similar is Derrick Rose. I think, I want to say after he was coming off the first surgery, came out and was averaging like 25 points a preseason game and, you know, was hitting everything. At one point was hitting like 70 or 80% of his threes. And again, we're talking about Derrick Rose, who, you know, doesn't hit anywhere near even 40% of his threes, and sometimes not 30. So, you know, preseason games, people aren't playing at completely full speed. Melo had something to prove there early on, whereas other people did not. And it's going to take him a while to get his rhythm. I think the concerning thing at first was that he seemed to be hijacking the offense at times during the first few games where he would just force a shot. And, you know, you heard him make comments during the preseason about how he was taking a lot of jumpers in spots where he might not do it. I think something like 85% of his shots in preseason were jump shots, which is really high for him. And he was saying that I was more concerned about that than I was about the idea of getting to the basket and making sure that I could get in rhythm with my mid-range jumper, because that's such a big part of his game specifically. So it's going to take him a while to get his legs under him. It is a little concerning that it hasn't come back, but at the same time, I know I did a predictions column and kind of predicted that that would take a while for him, probably at least 8 games and maybe not long, if not longer, so for that to come back.
Go ahead. I thought you were done.
No, I'm all done.
Oh, all right. Then I'll go then. This is something I just found before we were about to do the podcast. He's one of 6 players in the NBA right now that have played at least 100 minutes to have an assist percentage of 20 or above or a rebound percentage above 19.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of shows you it's flying under the radar a little bit, but he's moved the ball pretty well. There are times, and again, it's the most noticeable part of the game where he tries to do a little bit too much on offense. But he's had a couple games where he's moved the ball extremely well, where he has 5 assists, 6 assists. He's been developing a really good rapport on the court with Robin Lopez in terms of finding him when a second man is running at him, or if people are kind of neglecting Lopez, or Melo looks like he's going to pull up for a jumper and kind of just slides a pass to Lopez underneath the basket. So he's still kind of learning the synergy with KP. Melo throws the ball really hard, and KP's hands are not the greatest yet, and so I think he's still learning his teammates. But it's a good sign that Melo is moving the ball as well as he is. I think Ian Begley wrote a story about how his passing numbers are up in certain situations this year. And he's had pretty good synergy with some teammates, considering the fact that he hasn't played with a lot of these guys before.
The Bucks make the mistake of, and it's surprising coming from Jason Kidd, who played with him, that they sent the hard double at him. And when he gets doubled, and it's blatantly obvious like that, he tends to move the ball and make the correct pass. Where, to me, he struggles a little bit more is how the Spurs play defense, where it looks like he's getting one-on-one coverage, but they're shading towards him. And that's when he'll tend to force, because he just has so much confidence in himself that he can score when he's defended one-on-one. He thinks it's an advantage, and it's a better shot than they're going to get in other situations.
Exactly. Yeah, that, I mean, that, those are the defenses that have always kind of given Carmelo the most trouble. You think about the Spurs, the past Indiana regime, the Celtics, where they have enough bodies to throw at him one-on-one, but also basically the way people have described it to me is like a guy and a half, because you have a second guy shading there, and so Melo's not going to just dribble right past that first guy without seeing someone else step up quickly. And so it's kind of a pseudo double team, or it's a potential double team if Melo doesn't play it the right way. And so it's still probably quicker, better for him to move the ball quickly than it is for him to just try to jab step three times and then take a contested fade away. And you saw a couple times Kawhi Leonard was right there. You know, that might have been the best individual defense I've ever seen someone play on Carmelo, quite honestly, that other night against the Spurs. So that's what gives him trouble still, is when he's got so much confidence, especially off the surgery, to just be able to beat anybody one-on-one. And I think sometimes against LeBron and against Kobe, there's even more of a desire to go one-on-one just because, you know, he likes the bright lights. He likes to have those matchups. So you're right. Jason Kidd throws such hard doubles at him that it almost becomes easy, like almost like a multiple choice exam where, you know, it's A or B, and Melo has a very clear choice to make when you've got two guys standing in his face. Unless it's an end of game situation, Melo's normally not going to take that shot. So, you know, it's really easy for him. But I'm actually working on a story for Wednesday's paper about something like that. The fact that they just played Milwaukee, Melo was able to look at film, and we talked about that, just how he was making better decisions in that game than he did in the first one. He was like, well, I had just seen them on film. And so he makes really good adjustments when he's just watched a team or just played against the team. He remembers enough to where he knows what spots to pick out and shoot from and what places that he's going to get doubled from. And so
his playoff numbers say differently. His playoff numbers say differently.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a little different with playoffs because you can make all sorts of adjustments. And then again, too, with you know,
the bright lights,
the guy, the bright lights, and the fact that he wants to take it on his shoulders, and the fact that sometimes he kind of has to. I mean, sometimes he's had poor teammates or who are playing poorly that even if he moves the ball to them, he doesn't have the confidence that they're going to score. Jason Kidd, J.R. Smith in that last playoff series that they had. So I understand that. Yeah, but that's different. And again, those are series against those teams. We're talking about the Celtics, the Pacers. And those are teams that defend him really well anyway, that have good individual people to defend him. But yeah, you're right. And regular season, it's the same thing where his April numbers are fantastic and then his May numbers are always right at the bottom of the barrel because of how much he's pressing.
All right, let's shift to Derek Fisher. Let's start positive. Something that the Knicks haven't always done well in the past is bringing players in, getting the most out of them, developing young talent. And those are two things right now that, whether it be getting positive contributions from Derek Williams, what we're seeing from the rookies right away, the jump from Langston Galloway from year one to year two, even once his shooting percentage drops and he stops shooting 60% from three, he's a better player than he was last year. These are little things that are progressing well under Derek Fisher. Where do you think the improvement is coming from that type of stuff?
I think a vast amount of those improvements are the fact that Fisher has been more vocal about the idea of trying to get guys shots earlier in the clock. Because let's be honest, if you put two or three of those guys that we were just talking about in a set offense, it doesn't work. Derek Williams, and I've said this repeatedly, we'll probably write it again at some point, I've asked him about it, kind of the counterintuitive notion of him learning the offense and then actually becoming a worse player for it. And he kind of laughed when I asked the question, but he was like, you're probably right to some extent because I'm someone that plays much better on my instinct. And for right now, the offense is allowing me to do that, in part because they were running up and down the floor so much in preseason and getting out in transition, and that's where he is best. That's where he can make the most use of his athleticism. It's not just in a set offense, and quite frankly, you still see times where he's out of place on that side of the floor because he doesn't know the offense completely. And that, to some extent, I think it's actually better that it is that way for him. So getting the offense flowing quicker, it helps Jaren Grant. It helps Langston Galloway, who has been way less shy about the idea of pulling up in transition when no one's there. Galloway could end up being the poster child for the Knicks kind of pivoting away from horrible player development to good player development if they get to that point, because he looks like a totally different player in some ways. Not completely, because he was already a pretty good defender last year. He already was a pretty good offensive player in terms of moving the ball and running the offense. But the big knock on him last year was that after a while he just really couldn't shoot. And whether he's open, whether he's guarded, now it kind of doesn't matter. Like, every situation, he's just hitting everything. And like you said, it won't stay that way. But, you know, the fact that he's essentially leading the NBA in three-point percentage after a week and a half is really telling, and it's a good sign. So that's all up good. But the fact that they're trying to incorporate way more pick and rolls than they did last year, the fact that they're playing with way more pace than they did last year and not just relying on the triangle or what Kobe called the square, it's helpful, and it gets guys easier shots, and it's going to make players look a lot better when they're getting shots where there's only one or two guys back on defense and not completely guarded and the defense is jumbled. So I think that going to that wholesale and not worrying about, you know, the second unit sometimes looking out of control because of how fast they're playing, I think it's helped them quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm on Basketball Reference right now, and just looking at their numbers across the board, it's so obvious how much better schematically they are on both ends. Number one, they're 10th in offensive rating, 17th in defensive rating. They're 19th in pace. Now, these two are the ones that I think where the change in identity, I guess you would consider a change in their identity. They're 9th in free throw rate and 18th in three-point attempt rate. And that's something they got killed in both categories last year. Defensively, they're 25th in free throw to field goal percentage. So, I mean, that's where every game last year, I remember you and I, we'd go back and forth about it, and we'd show, well, how much did they lose by in free throws and three-pointers this night? And it was like historic type numbers, and right now that's not happening.
Yeah, no, the big thing, I mean, think back to, I'll harp on this more, I guess maybe because it's been so bad for so many years, particularly since Woodson was there. I guess right after they made the switch from D'Antoni, you saw the Knicks go from a really, really fast team, an up-tempo team, to the opposite, obviously. Their offenses are different, they allow for different things within the offense, and so they had been at the, you know, within the bottom five in pace for the last 4 or 5 years now. And obviously, you know, they got out to a really great start against Milwaukee. They were really fast and up-tempo that night. And the difference was, you know, after those first few games, they actually had the two games, one against the Spurs and then one against Cleveland, where they didn't score any fast break points at all. And it was funny because up to that point, everyone was killing me for not really having written much about Derek Williams. I wrote a preview in which I don't even think I mentioned him, and people were like, how could you not mention him? And mostly it was because of space in the paper, not having enough space in the paper. I could only go 8 or 9 deep, and I had to include Vujicic because I knew he was going to start. And so I would have included Williams, but didn't have the space to. But people were like, he led us in scoring in preseason. How can you not include him as being a big factor on this team? And then seeing how irrelevant he kind of became when the team wasn't able to get out and run. And so I think that the commonality between the Spurs and the Cavs game was that they didn't score anything in transition, and you didn't see Derek Williams playing that much because he wasn't able to do anything. He wasn't able to be effective in those settings. And so it opens up so much when you're able to run and not just get stagnant and rely on the triangle offense without any screens. You know, it just gives them a much different look. It helps them on both sides of the floor to get up and run up and down. It helps them get to the line more. I think that could end up being the thing I was most wrong about this season, was how much they get to the line. But it helps Williams get to the line. It helps everybody get to the line when they're running, as opposed to just, you know, setting up and running a really slow offense. So they've looked much better in that regard. The playing style is much more appealing to watch. And, you know, it's honestly been a fun team to watch over the first few games of the season.
Okay, so now, while Fisher is doing better on these big picture things, when we get into game management type stuff, he's still struggling very much with rotation, where guys should be playing. Everyone knows about the starting backcourt. Now, where I think part of this goes back to Sasha should have just never been signed is really the issue here. Like, right now, he has to play. And for until the last game, he had been better than Calderon, whether people want to admit that or not, it's true. But when they've done so well with the young, finding the young talent, a guy like Galloway, they found cheap guys in Lance Thomas, who was 27, that's been a positive contributor for them, even someone like Amundsen, who is older. So why, instead of finding a guy who hasn't been a good player in Europe by the numbers, I never watched him, and hasn't really been relevant in an NBA sense for many years, why didn't they try and get a little bit more creative finding a guard than just settling on someone like him is more my complaint right now rather than him playing. Now, he's playing a little bit too much, but you can't play Galloway and Grant 45 minutes a game. Calderon and Sasha, with how this roster is constructed, do have to play until Aflalo gets back.
Yeah, I've said that even once they, you know, were done signing folks for the summer. To me, I have no issue with Seraphin. Well, actually, I do have a couple issues with Seraphin, but
Him playing these, he just shouldn't be in the rotation right now.
Right. I watch a guy like Kyle O'Quinn, who, quite frankly, has probably been one of their two or three best players to this point. And I think even PER would probably, you know, show that. You know, for all the credit that KP is getting and deserves right now, Kyle O'Quinn essentially would be averaging a double-double if he had more minutes each night. And he's been relatively efficient. He's been pretty good defensively. He's been getting blocks. Plays pretty sound defense. He rebounds very well. I just don't see a need for Seraphin there. And I say that within the context of their roster and the fact that it's very apparently clear that they need another good guard or two. And maybe, you know, in terms of free agency, maybe there weren't that many there to be had by the time that, you know, they looked up and spent most of their money. But even, and I can't really push him too hard because I don't think anybody else signed him either, but a guy like Darrell Wright is someone who can hit threes from the corner, who could play decent enough defense. Maybe I hadn't watched him enough to see whether his defense had, you know, come down a notch, but wasn't a great defender, wasn't a great scorer, wasn't a great three-point shooter, but was good enough and above average enough at enough things to where I feel like if you're going to make a decision between getting a post player who is above average in an area or two or a wing player that's above average in an area or two, I would have gone with a wing player before I would have signed another post player, especially within the context of considering that, you know, if I really get in a pinch, and quite frankly, I wouldn't even need to be in a pinch to play Carmelo with the four. There's no problem with playing him at the four if you need to. So you have extra big men if you really need it because you can kind of downshift and play smaller, whereas you really can't do that as easily. You can't play three or four big men at a time the way that you can play three or four smalls at a time. And so that was what I frankly didn't understand. And honestly, when they first signed Vujicic and I saw the reports of that, my initial sense was they're using this the same way they did with Shannon Brown, where he's going to come in, he's going to be a training camp guy, he's going to teach the offense, maybe he'll make the roster. But since he's been out of the league for years, it's probably more likely that he's just a training camp guy. I saw that the deal was guaranteed, and I was like, wow, I didn't think they were going to guarantee him anything. You could not have paid me anything to, you know, to have believed that he would be an opening day starter, even if it was just to replace someone else, you know, and to fill spot minutes for someone else who's not there yet in Aflalo. But, you know, I think Fisher definitely deserves some criticism for the way he's handled that. Calderon has gotten a ton of criticism when it's really not his fault as much as it is Fisher's for putting him in that role and putting Vujicic in that role. But, you know, I think I understand where he's coming from. It's very similar to the way Mike Woodson operated with his lineups in terms of wanting a placeholder there for someone else who's going to play big minutes. Woodson did it with JR and James White.
Yeah, but the difference was James White, he couldn't have played more than 12 minutes a game when they did that.
Yeah, and that, but I mean, the only real other thing Fisher could do, I guess, with the exception of playing the guards more, and I think he should do that, although he has played the guards more, and he's played the guards more than the starters at times, is to play Klay Anthony early. And I know a lot of fans feel very strongly that he should be playing. I kind of think he deserves a shot based on how he looked in preseason. But, you know, the truth is he's down a guy, and he's going to play Aflalo. Aflalo is going to be someone who gets 30 minutes a game. So part of this issue is going to go away. I understand why, with the way the team has played, they've looked better than a lot of people expect. And so people think maybe they could have had an extra win or two if you actually handled the rotations the right way. Maybe. But I'm not going to kill him for it just yet, just because we know it'd be different if, you know, if Aflalo were going to come back and only play 15 minutes a game and just replace Sasha's minutes as a starter. He might eliminate Sasha from the rotation entirely once he comes back. We don't know that. I mean, I don't know that, but I mean, Aflalo is that much better than someone like Wojcic that it's realistic to think that he could largely replace him completely. And if he does that, then the early season criticism will not really have been that important.
And it's fair to make that assumption based on when Aflalo, that game, it was against the Celtics, and before he got hurt, the Knicks were kind of playing their regular season rotation type thing. I'm pretty sure Sasha didn't play until Aflalo got hurt.
Exactly. He did not play at all. So that's what I'm saying. I don't know if we should expect that extreme, but when you think about it, Fisher has done stuff like that before. You go back to the beginning of last season, Fisher started Shane Larkin in place of Calderon. And then when Calderon came back, Larkin had two or three DNPs in a row. And so Fisher's done stuff like that before, where I think it's weird, and I think it hurts the disruption of someone's rhythm to play them a ton, especially a young player like Larkin, to play them a ton and then not at all. Whereas I think you could probably ease people into those roles, but he's done that sort of thing before. So I wouldn't go off the deep end like some people have said, where he deserves to be fired from the way he's managed the rotation. Like, that's silly. And I know you're not saying that, but...
No, I get frustrated with him.
He's going to play a lot of major minutes once he comes back anyway, and it's going to either take a toll at this point on Jose's minutes or Sasha's minutes or both. And so I wouldn't worry about it too much yet, but if Sasha's still getting major minutes once Aflalo is back, or he's making a decision to play Sasha over Aflalo, you know, then I think there's a major issue. Or if Aflalo continues to have injury problems and then they're still not changing the starting lineup even after that's happened, and and Vujicic and Jose are still struggling, then yeah, I think it's fair to complain about. But 5-6 games into a season, when you've got a starter, a clear starter who's not playing yet, you know, I'll save my bigger criticisms for them. But it's very clear that Galloway's been their best guard this season, hands down. And I mean, he's been good enough to have won the starting job. Grant has regressed a little bit in the last few games, and I think people are realizing he does have shortcomings that he can get better at, but he's not, you know, a clear starter at this point the way Galloway is, in my mind.
No, what's really kind of amazing about the Grant thing is he's probably a league average player right now, if we're being generous, and I like him long term. I think he's going to continue to develop, and he'll be a borderline starter on a really good team. I think he's probably your first guard off the bench as like a long-term thing if I was projecting forward. But it's just so much clearer how much better they are offensively when he plays. It's kind of, even though the numbers don't necessarily show that, just the flow looks better when he's out there.
The reason the numbers don't reflect it is because, you know, they're not impacting his field goal percentage. He's going to the line a ton, maybe even a little bit more than Galloway is. And so that's not going, you know, his field goal percentage is probably just close to as bad, if not worse, than Jose's is so far. But the difference is that he's creating a lot of different looks that Jose can't create. He gets to the basket a lot more, drives 5 or 6 times a game compared to Jose driving to the basket maybe once a game. And so that's a major, major difference. And that's not even to speak of what he does on the defensive end. I posted a tweet a couple of days ago that they literally force, you know, the Galloway-Grant duo, that lineup with Porzingis forces twice as many turnovers as a lineup with Calderon and Vujicic with Porzingis. I think at the time, obviously small sample size, but something like 28 or 29 turnovers per 100 possessions they forced, as compared to the other group forcing maybe 14 or 15. So it's a it's I think people fell in love with the duo so quickly from Summer League, from preseason, and how quickly they seem to outplay the starters. Yes, but you still have to understand it within a context that Grant still has plenty to work through. It's becoming very apparent now that teams are going to sag back in the paint to defend him and dare him to shoot, which he really doesn't look like he wants to do. And so that's kind of the difference in his progression right now from a second-year Galloway, who is very, very comfortable shooting the ball and will make you pay if you leave him open.
Which, yeah, that's the same. If Grant's going to make a jump that maybe I wouldn't expect, it's going to – that if after this season to next season, he's going to have to prove that he can knock down that. He's going to have to make that mid-range jumper to be a viable starting point guard in the league. All right, let's talk about let's go Porzingis. I don't even he's good. I just watch him, I'm just like, holy shit, this guy's on the Knicks and he's really good. That's what I got.
it's really hard to kind of reconcile how impressive he's looked. You know, some of it I think, I know you've tweeted about this and I've seen responses to what you've said and what people have said to you and vice versa. It's really funny. People tweet me all the time. I think they assume whatever quotes I'm posting are from questions that I've asked, and I don't just post tweets to questions I've asked. I normally try to kind of say if I've asked the question so people have that context and so people can kind of differentiate between what I've asked and kind of how much more rooted in strategy or statistics that it is as opposed to what other people are asking about kind of narrative-based stuff. But, I posted a tweet yesterday saying, you know, someone asked Porzingis if he's surprised by his performance at this point. Porzingis said no. And that was literally all he said. He didn't elaborate. He just said no. And people were like, that's a stupid question. What do you expect him to say? And I get where they're coming from. I get that in some ways it might seem like a loaded question, that he has to answer it that way. If he says yes, he's surprised by how he's played, then it makes him look weird. But I do understand why the person phrased the question that way. Phil came in saying that this guy is a project. He came in saying this guy is a boom or bust sort of pick for us potentially because he has so much potential, but at the same time he might not ever come close to realizing it. And then obviously a lot of people had not seen the guy play, and even when we did see him play, we saw him in Summer League. He showed some great flashes, but he also couldn't grab the ball. He couldn't rebound. He wasn't the kind of guy that demanded the ball, and he got shoved around a lot in preseason. We watched a little Okafor, although KP did kind of learn how to front him and play him better over the course of that game. We saw Okafor push him around. I remember the last couple minutes of a game they played against the Lakers in Summer League, and Julius Randle just literally rammed through the guy a couple times, and KP didn't even know how to go about guarding him, and so it was interesting to see KP get the better of him yesterday. But we also didn't see KP dunking on anybody in Summer League. So, I mean, I get why people are saying that it's, you know, that shame on the media or shame on certain people for saying that they're surprised by his performance because they've never seen him, so it's not fair to be surprised. But in response to that, Phil himself, and to be honest, I've run into Mills in the hallway, Steve Mills in the hallway. He's surprised by it. He's said he's surprised by it, that he's really pleasantly surprised by how he's looked. And KP was not doing this in Summer League against lesser competition. So it is kind of a rapid progression, even from what we had seen. He's been incredible so far. And, normally I'm kind of the one trying to kind of tamp down the expectations that people have. And Knicks fans do this all the time with rookies. Shumpert, Landry Fields looked really good for that one season. You don't want people to get carried away because then they get disappointed later on.
No, but this time they can get carried away.
Yeah.
go ahead. Go jump off the bridge.
Tell everybody not to get carried away here because nobody's ever really had the skill set that this guy has at his size. It's scary. And he's, I mean, even just on a really baseline level, he's basically either second or first in every major statistical category that they have. I mean, between scoring, I think he's second to Melo. I think rebounding, before yesterday's game, he was second to Melo. He might have surpassed him at this point. In terms of blocks, steals, he was leading the team in both categories. In terms of PER, he was higher than Melo was. I mean, it's all a small sample size, but none of it looks fluky because they're playing good competition. And he's holding his own against very good players, dunking on very good players. And so, you know, the foul issue is something that you have to get better with. I put out a story kind of suggesting that it's not just Calderon and Vujicic. You can't blame those two for his foul troubles because he gets a lot of fouls that have nothing to do with those two. And his foul rate is actually higher with Galloway and Grant so far than it is with those two on the court. So he's going to learn that. That'll come with time. He's had foul issues his whole career, even overseas. But it's really hard not to get excited. He hasn't even shot the ball well yet. And you figure that that sort of thing will come with time, or it will at least improve from what he's done so far. So he's incredibly fun to watch. He's incredibly confident. He's not afraid to mix it up and get on the floor for a loose ball. I really enjoy watching him play, and I completely understand why Knicks fans are the way they are about this kid, over the moon over this kid, because he's played well enough to deserve that sort of praise.
You have the guy who the Knicks have never, pretty much since Ewing, they haven't had the guy that you drafted that you thought, hey, maybe 4 years down the line, this is the guy we can build our team around. They have their what the T-Wolves had with Karl Anthony Towns, what the Pelicans had with Anthony Davis. I'm not saying he's going to end up turning into that, but who you could sit there and you could go, there's a path here that something really, really special could end up happening, and it's not an experience this fan base has had very often.
Yeah, no, and I think that's part of the reason that normally, if anything, I try to temper people's expectations, because you don't want to see someone get hit with unfair hopes or aspirations or expectations, and then for them to actually be a decent player and still be criticized because they didn't live up to what someone was hoping for. But the reason people get so excited is because, and I've used this example several times, it's kind of like a comet shooting across the sky. It's like the blood moon that only comes around so often. The Knicks don't ever have draft picks in the first place. And then when they do, you know, they either turn out to be complete busts that never come to the league at all, or they turn out to be trade bait for someone else, you know, 2-3 years down the line. And, you know, I've cited the statistic that I found several times now. You have to go back to Charlie Ward to find the last first-round pick that they re-signed to a multi-year deal. And so you're going back to, like, the early 90s when they drafted this guy. So it's just so rare for them to have anybody that looks like it's someone they can legitimately just build around and that be their franchise star. And I think people are seeing it right now. And it's, you know, and it's not even just him. It's the fact that Galloway all of a sudden is forcing us to rethink the way that we view him as, you know, a piece that they build with going forward. Grant, you know, even though he's cooled down a little bit, Grant looks like he could be a starting point guard for this team. And so it's kind of scary to think about, but, you know, how quickly we make these judgments about what the long-term picture looks like for a franchise, and how for a while the Knicks and the Nets both kind of look screwed.
The Nets still look screwed.
They still look screwed, so there's no changing that. But you can't mention them and the Knicks in the same breath right now because, I mean, one has... I mean, and that's not even to take anything away from Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. I like him a lot.
Oh, he should be a very good player.
I really like him a lot. I mean, there's a clear, clear difference in terms of, like, what we would think one guy's ceiling is versus the other, especially when you talk about what position they play and how the likelihood of them being special and his size versus Hollis-Jefferson's. I mean, it's not – you can't compare KP's ceiling to most of the guys in this class. And – to add to that, and I've talked about this a lot on Twitter as well, this class is just, like, scary. You know, I said back in, I think, I was looking back through old tweets yesterday. I think I flubbed what I said on Twitter. I don't think I ever said that the whole top 10 would be in great shape, but I definitely said that the Knicks would really have to screw things up to be in the top 5 and not get somebody really, really good.
I loved the draft class so much. My whole angle going into the draft was you should trade back to 6, 7, or 8 or something like that, because you could get an additional piece that wouldn't be available to you at a price in free agency, plus you could still get a good player. So I did the whole draft thing with Vecini last year, so I was exposed to a lot of these guys a good amount. And I absolutely love this class going in, and it's outdoing my expectations for it.
It's exceeding every. I mean, like, it's too soon to say it right now, but I mean, just like, you know, the way too early snap judgment, it could end up being one of the great classes we've seen. And I mean, like, I don't want to necessarily say it could end up being the best, but it's, I mean, the fact that we could have a conversation about whether it should be mentioned in those same breath with, you know,
96 and 04 are the ones you start thinking of.
The fact that we can even, like, put it in that sort of stratosphere, that's how good they look so far. I mean, even the guys that have plenty to learn. We talked about Porzingis with his foul trouble and the fact he's not even shooting well. Justice Winslow, I saw Ethan Skolnick post a stat today that said basically the whole top 10 in terms of plus minus to this point is a bunch of Warriors and Cavs. And then you've got Justice Winslow at number 11. Justice Winslow, he's not even starting for them, I don't think.
No, he's coming off the bench.
I mean, but like, this is a guy that hasn't even really figured out how to score yet in this league. And it's just like, you can't take him off the floor because of how great he is on defense. And Towns has been incredible. And I keep seeing all these ESPN stats and info tweets basically laying out that, like, this guy is the first person to ever, you know, the third person in league history to ever post this many points, this many rebounds in his first six games. And, you know, that's talking about Towns. And then you have a separate stat like that that's talking about Porzingis. And then, you know, that's not even mentioning the fact that you've got a guy like Cauley Stein, who far and away has been the best plus-minus player for Sacramento and is a great rim protector and flies up and down the floor. Like, you know, it doesn't even account for the fact that you've got a couple point guards that can turn out to be really good. Okafor's averaging 20 a game so far. It's insane. And, you know, so you definitely have at least four or five potential stars in this class, and you could maybe even go beyond that. That's not even touching the bottom of this class and the guys who were taken in the middle and the bottom of this first round. So it's a lot of fun to consider, but it's really rare for Knicks fans to be able to enjoy that sort of excitement too, because they finally got a guy that might be their future.
Well, what's amazing about it is how well the Melo trade worked out for them from a draft pick perspective. The picks they're going to lose ended up being probably mid to late teens, and they got the one that was four. Like, that's so crazy lucky.
That's an interesting way to think about it. I definitely hadn't thought about that way. It is fortunate. I mean, a lot of times it's the luck of the draw. You know, like you said, it is fortunate. But I mean, thinking about it a different way, you know, for a while, they were on pace during that 37-win season where they had to give the pick up. You know, they were on pace to be one of the worst teams in the league for a while. They struggled out of the gate. I think they started like 2-9 or
no. They should have made the playoffs that year, but Mike Woodson's an idiot.
But here's the thing: I honestly wonder if they had a draft pick that season, whether they would have held on to those guys that they kept, and whether they might have made a move to just tank. I don't know. I'm honestly not sure. But we didn't even have to consider that question because they had no pick.
No, that was a 45-win team that Mike Woodson turned into a 30-win team. It was quite the accomplishment.
I remember at one point, I remember writing the story. You remember I wrote that column on why I thought Woodson should be fired. At one point, they were on pace for less than 25 wins, and that was a good 15 games into the season.
And then Bargnani got hurt, and they finished the year 19-4 with the rotation they should have been playing the whole season.
They caught fire toward the end of that year, but for a while they were on pace to have a really high lottery pick. It just wasn't their own pick anymore. And so, I mean, it is interesting to consider it that way, but I mean, it's very, very interesting. I'll put it that way. And from looking at it now and the direction that they're headed in now with the kind of potential star power they have now, you really wish they did have that pick for this coming year, just in case, you know, this has just been a hot start and they're not going to be all that great and they did fall in the lottery. And it'd be great to have one more pick to kind of build on. But even if this is all you get, I mean, you might have hit a home run with Porzingis. And I think people, even the biggest skeptics, I think even Asola was saying that, you know, it looks like a home run so far, and I don't really know how you could debate that at this point. You really don't see anybody debating it right now.
Now, what I like about the kid going forward is, if they do this right, and build right. And now I know some people kind of like the Lopez Porzingis thing, but when you have the chance to be able to build a five-out offense and protect the rim with your center, I just think that's the direction you absolutely have to go. Now, maybe it's 2 years from now that you're able to fully implement that plan, but that has to start being the direction. If they do this smartly, that's the direction you're thinking. And I don't think a lot of people are thinking like that, because I saw Nate Jones posted, should Porzingis be a 4 or 5 long term? And the majority of his responses were that he should be a 4. The dude's 7'3". The way he moves, this, and I don't even want him to put on that much more weight. I'd rather him keep his lateral quickness and athleticism, jumping, and what he's able to do vertically, because the most important aspect of a center defense right now is defending the pick and roll, being able to move and cover up for other mistakes. I'd much rather have lateral quickness. And he's so big, even these guys who are stronger than him, who can back him down, he just has to stick his hands up. Good luck trying to get over that.
Oh, yeah. I don't see the payoff in playing him at the 4 long term, unless you have another guy that can do what he does. I mean, the truth is, you want the whole point of having a spaced out offense like that is so that you can have guys gravitate further toward the 3-point line and leave a guy like Grant the room to drive so that he's not forced to kind of camp out and shoot mid-range jumpers. You space out the defense and give someone more room to probe through the holes. And so, I mean, you also, like you said, Porzingis is showing enough prowess as a shot blocker and as a good defender that can move his feet. Why would you want to play him? I feel like all it does is clog things more offensively. And I think what we're going to learn long term, and you and I have talked about this as well, at this rate, if he progresses at all and can put on slightly more weight to where he's able to, you know, box guys out in the post and really hold his own down low, I think what you're probably going to run into is a little bit of a logjam between him and Lopez, where Lopez is playing out the last year or two of his contract here, and really, you know, Porzingis has really surpassed him in a way where he's the best center, best option at center for this team, even though Lopez still looks fine. I mean, he looks really good, actually, to this point in the season, but that's kind of how quickly the conversation has changed from can he contribute as a rookie to, you know, would he actually be the best center for this team right now? Probably not right now, but long term, I don't think there's any question that you get more payoff from him playing the 5. And, you know, his skill set, you should be, you know, salivating at the mouth to play him there so that you can move Melo to the 4 and not have to worry about those problems on defense with him chasing guys around the perimeter at the 3. So I don't think there's any question that long term that's the best spot for him. You don't need a rim protecting 5 when you have someone at his height that can block shots the way he does. And protect the rim the way he does.
And then depending, there's not a ton of free agents out there this summer that are going to be high impact. So if you have Lopez and his $12 million, you still have O'Quinn, and then you could try and move Lopez for another wing or a guard in addition to whoever they sign in the offseason, and then you just go and find a cheaper third big man, that's not something that should be completely ruled out.
Sure. I mean, that's actually going to be interesting for them, you know, just looking at the big picture, period. Their free agency right now, they're going to have some money, but like you said, there's really no marquee guys out there, and the ones that are going to be out there are not people that I think that they should be throwing a ton of money at. You know, someone tweeted me earlier in the day, said, do you think they should go get Mike Conley? And, you know, half of our conversation at this point has been how great Langston Galloway has looked and how Jaren Grant looks like he could legitimately be a starting point guard for them. So, no, I don't think you want to throw. I mean, in this environment, with how few stars there are in this next class for free agency, Mike Conley is probably going to get a max offer from someone, more than likely. So, you know, the idea of going to just kind of fill other holes, you want Porzingis to be playing the 5 in part because if you were to, let's say, you know, 2-3 years from now, as Lopez is getting ready to make his exit, or if he starts to age and not play as well, you can't afford to go. You know, you cannot afford to have Porzingis potentially be a star in the low post as a rim protector, and then go pay a separate rim protector. It's expensive, and it's kind of not conducive to what their needs are. Again, without knowing what they're going to do a year or two from now, they need wing players. They don't need another guy that can come in and defend the rim. And I think even now you're seeing that they're overloaded in the front court to where they don't even have enough time for some of their players. O'Quinn is also signed for 4 years and can play that position as well. He's not all that tall. I think he's 6'9 or 6'10, but I think he can more than hold his own in center for Spurs during the game as well.
Yeah, I'm a lunatic, so I've already mapped out my free agency plan for the team for the offseason. There's three guys I would look at if I were them, and I'll say this incessantly on Twitter and following and podcasts throughout the year, so you'll know. The three guys I would look at are George Hill, Evan Fournier, and Batum. If I'm a little worried about his shooting, I need to see him perk up. He's still to start this year, he's continued his struggles from last year, so I don't want a small forward that's shooting 36% and 32%. I'm assuming it's eventually going to jump back up, and it's not the same as last year, but if that doesn't, I kind of would shy away from him. But I think those are three guys that would fit very well into what this team's doing and what they need.
I struggle with Batum only because he has the bouts of inconsistency that I think would drive people nuts sometimes. He's really good sometimes. In some games, he's like a dominant player. He actually had a game a year or two ago against the Knicks in Portland where he just went off, had like 21 in the first half or something. It was just hitting threes from everywhere. He's the kind of person that his length creates so many problems when he's really locked in defensively and can get deflections and can play a couple different positions because of how long he is. He does have those bouts of inconsistency though that I worry about a little bit. It would probably depend on what the money was, but I think a lot of teams would probably go after a guy like that. But my hunch is that he'd really get paid quite a bit. That said, Fournier could be in the conversation to get paid quite a bit as well because he's played pretty well at times. And he's got a really nice skill set. There's not a lot he can't do. He's not by any means, not a bad defender. He can defend, pretty well on the wing at times. He can really shoot. He's a really good slasher and can create for himself. And I think that's kind of, to me, what the Knicks need the most. Even after a summer where they acquire Jaren Grant, they go get Derek Williams, they get a healthy Melo back, and they get someone like KP who can get to the line, their free throw rate still looks great compared to where it was. I mean, when you're in top 10, top 15 in free throw rate, when you were pretty much dead last year, that's great. But they still don't have a lot of guys that can create for themselves offensively. And I think that's why you see them stagnate and struggle to score when they're not really getting the fast breaks and, transition opportunities as much. Because really, Grant, and part of this is part of the problem with Grant so far, is that he dribbles around so much just looking for a crease somewhere because he doesn't trust somebody else to get a look in terms of being able to get into the paint. Or he dribbles into the paint, doesn't know what he's going to do with the ball, and then kicks the ball way back out, 20 feet away from where he's passing it from. And so you just don't see enough guys in their lineup that can really create and slash in a set offense, and I think Fournier would give that to them. So I'd really like him. Hill, kind of is a polar opposite from Fournier in terms of being able to get into the paint and get him to create his own shot that way. But, he's a really, really good shooter most of the time, and I think for his position, he's really unusually long. He's a really tall point guard.
He's the type of guy Phil would really like.
You would love him because he's not, Phil has never really seemed overly vested in guys that can penetrate as point guards. Most of the guys don't do that. They're kind of more just they hang out on the perimeter, and they make you pay if someone kicks out of a double team. John Paxson, BJ Armstrong, Derek Fisher,
and
Calderon.
Hill's like a drugged up version of those guys.
Exactly, because he's a lot bigger than most of those guys. A lot of those guys, 6'2", 6'3", Calderon kind of fits that perfectly. He's like 6'3", spot up shooter for the most part. Hill is a spot-up shooter for the most part, but he's also 6'5 and can really defend. My concern there is that he's older than all those other guys we mentioned, and that he is, it seems like Phil has kind of not done the greatest job sometimes, at least with Calderon's case, projecting how quickly those guys are going to age. I worry a little bit less about Hill because he can defend, whereas Calderon was already a poor defender when they acquired him. But he is starting to hit that. He's right there at that age where, like,
how old is Hill?
I think Hill is either 29 or 30 right now. And so by the time you get him, he's right around the same area as where Melo is in terms of the age. And so I don't worry about it, but I do think if you're going to get him and then you look into signing him to 3-4 years, that he could kind of hit the same stage that we're concerned about and seeing from certain guys right now.
Yeah, Hill's he's 29 right now. He'll be 30 next season.
Yeah, so I'm not terribly concerned about it because I really like Hill, and I actually think he'd fit what Phil likes perfectly. I just worry about some of the things. Like, you know, if he does slow down defensively, that's a big part of the reason I would actually want him, is because defensively he does some stuff that most point guards can't do. He's also not a great passer for someone who's a point guard, but I think within the offense they play, you could probably be okay without that because you're getting enough looks from other people. But, and those are all good fits for them too, because I don't think that the Knicks are going to be in position to sign a max-level guy, but I don't know that they fully need a max-level guy. Even though the media is going to pressure the Knicks into trying to, you know, to find that second star, Porzingis might become that in the next couple years, and it's not to say they should bank on that, but I don't think they have the money to go get a legitimate star anyway, a second, you know, all-star caliber guy. I don't know if anyone's going to want to do that anyway. But Hill and Fournier, those are guys that might be attainable for them and might actually fit what they do better, similar to what they did this past summer.
All right. Oh, you got anything you want to plug and get out there?
Well, what I was saying before, it's not published yet. I'm not even done yet. I haven't even submitted it. But I'm going to have a piece later this week that kind of looks at Carmelo and how much, when you think about baseball players and kind of how certain guys see their batting averages just climb and climb when they, depending on how many times they face the same pitcher in that game, so the second or third time through the order, and how pitchers kind of struggle against certain guys after a guy's seen their pitches. Carmelo has a tendency to do that when he's playing against a team, either in short proximity to when he last played them, or when he's playing them for a second, third, or fourth time. And so I'm going to write a story about that and kind of how, you know, obviously Melo's waiting on his legs to really recover and come back from all the time off. But I also think that seeing some of these teams for a second, third, fourth time, he tends to do much, much better statistically. And so there's reason to think that he'll improve over the course of the season. And that's kind of what I took from that Milwaukee game. So he just seemed to be seeing the floor a lot better than he did the first time and had a sense of what to expect. And so that story should be fun, because just talking to him about his film watching process and kind of what he takes from certain things and the statistics to back up the fact that he's one of the few players in the league who gets better every single time he plays against a certain team.
All right, and you can find Chris's stories. He always posts them on his Twitter, at Herring, WSJ, H-E-R-R-I-N-G, W-S-J. WallStreetJournal.com will get you to the website, right?
Yep, that's it,
WSJ.com. Okay, cool. Chris, always appreciate your time. I'll make sure I bother you again down the line.
Please do. Really appreciate it.
All right, that wraps up another edition of the Podium Game Podcast.